Neil Jaffer, Deputy Director of the ACLU's National Security Program. I'm speaking with filmmaker Rory Kennedy, whose latest documentary, The Ghosts of Abu Ghraib, investigates the abuse and torture of prisoners in the infamous Iraqi prison. Rory, let me first say how much I admire the film. I thought it was powerful and also thought-provoking.
But I want to begin by asking you why you made the film and how you decided to focus on this issue.
Well, first of all, thank you for saying those nice things. I had originally been developing a project with HBO about looking at genocides from the perspective of perpetrators, and specifically looking at the question of how do ordinary people commit extraordinary acts of violence. And we were looking at a number of examples of this, both in current day times as well as historical examples of genocide. And at this point, during this time, the photographs had come out, and I kept finding that I was asking the same questions of people who committed genocides as I was asking of the people who were involved in the abuse that occurred of Abu Ghraib. Who were these people? What motivated them to do what they did? Were they the kid next door thrown into a situation? Were they monsters? How could somebody treat another person so inhumanely? And so I came back to HBO and with the idea of asking the same question, but looking at Abu Ghraib as the example, as opposed to examples that were happening in other places around the world. And so they thought that was a good idea, and we then started on our way of looking at Abu Ghraib.
That's interesting. You use the phrase ordinary people, and I think that there's probably still the impression amongst much of the American public that the people who perpetrated the abuses at Abu Ghraib weren't ordinary people at all, but were rather statists in a way that the rest of us aren't.
I think, you know, that was, I think, to some degree, my thought going into this project as well, and I think it's what most of us think about when we think of people who commit these atrocious acts, that they have to be monsters. And, you know, I think it would be much simpler if they were, but in fact, I think it's a much more complicated story, and we obviously try to look into that in the film.
Well, the film itself starts with Stanley Milgram's experiment. Can you say a little bit about the experiment and what you think the experiment tells us about what took place at Abu Ghraib?
Yeah, so this was an experiment that was done in 1961 by Stanley Milgram, as you say, and the idea behind the experiment was to bring in people in the New Haven community, a range of different people, who were asked to electrocute somebody that they knew to be innocent. And what they found was that 100% of the participants were willing to electrocute an innocent person. And over 50% were willing to do so at 450 volts, which is arguably a lethal amount, simply because they were asked to do so by somebody in a white coat, somebody in a position of authority. And I think the reason that the study is relevant to what happened at Abu Ghraib is that when I did further exploration of exactly what happened at Abu Ghraib, what I found in asking people why they did what they did is that they all said the same thing, which is they did it because they were told to do it.
Right. And one of the MPs that you, the military police, whom you interviewed said, I didn't feel like it was my place to question anything.
Right, and that, I think, was the sentiment of most of the MPs who I spoke with. You know, a lot of the MPs who were there at the time who were involved in the abuse were young people. Israel Rivera found out about 9/11 when he was in an Algebra 2 class in high school. So, you know, a lot of these guys are women are 19, 20, 21 years old, and are just coming out of basic training, and, you know, what they're told over and over again is to do what they're told and to not question that authority. And if you question the authority, you potentially can jeopardize not only your own health and safety, but that of the soldiers around you. And I think that was to some significant degree the case of what happened at Abu Ghraib. It was also, as far as I can tell, and from all of the people I spoke to, and we ended up interviewing well over a dozen people who were at Abu Ghraib in the fall of 2003 when most of the abuses occurred, what I found was that this was really standard operating procedure. So, you know, the idea that this was just nine bad apples on the night shift or Animal House on the night shift or some of these other kind of theories that have been thrown out there was absolutely not the perception that I got from the people I spoke to.
Well, with that background, let me ask you a question then about responsibility. When you screened the film last week in Washington, Jeffrey Toobin started the conversation by stating that the ultimate responsibility for what went on was not with the prison guards, but with former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and with President Bush. Is that how you would attribute blame for what took place?
Well, I don't think the film tries to suggest that the soldiers who were involved in the abuse shouldn't be held responsible. I do think they did commit the abuse and certainly should be held accountable for what they did. But the reality is that they have served time and that they have been held accountable for the abuse that occurred there and their role in it. But the people who haven't been held accountable for their contribution are people up the chain of command. To date, 11 low-ranking soldiers have served time for the abuses that took place. And no high-ranking official has faced significant penalties whatsoever.
Right, and that's true of both military and civilian officials.
Absolutely, and so I think that's really kind of the issue that the film addresses, is the fact that there are people who not only knew what was happening at Abu Ghraib at this time and were aware of it, but in fact authorized it, people very high up the chain of command.
Right, right. Well, let's just expand on that a little, because I think it's important. White House counsel Alberto Gonzalez, who advised the president that the Geneva Conventions were quaint and obsolete, is now Attorney General, and Jay Bybee, who wrote the torture memo, is now a federal appellate judge. Do you think that and it goes on, you know, down the list, do you think that the American political process has responded in the way that it should have to what took place at Abu Ghraib and more generally at detention centers in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere?
No. I don't. From the information that I know, it seems like there is a significant amount of evidence that suggests that people very high up the chain of command were well aware of what happened at Abu Ghraib, as well as, you know, other detention facilities throughout Iraq and Afghanistan and Guantanamo, and none of, or very few of whom have been held accountable, and as you point out, many of them have in fact been promoted. You know, the reality of the situation at Abu Ghraib is that we don't know exactly what happened at Abu Ghraib, because we have not had to date a 9/11 style inquiry as to what exactly happened. The government will, and the military will say, you know, we've done dozens of investigations, as the film points out, but all of them have been either financed by the military or the Department of the Navy, or by the administration, or have been so narrowly focused down the chain of command that they weren't able to actually ask the questions of people in a position.
Well, one of the people you interview is Admiral John Hudson, and he says that although we've had dozens of these investigations so far, we haven't had, he says, what you just said, that we haven't had one with real teeth. Is that
correct?
Something you think is still important, or do you think it's important now that the country move on and put this behind us?
I do think that we really need to examine what happened at Abu Ghraib. I think it was a seminal event in American history and arguably world history, and that to say that situation has been addressed, that we know what happened, that we need to move on, I think it doesn't do it justice. And I don't think it's fair to the American citizens to simply put 11 people in prison and tie it up in a neat little bow and pretend to move on. This situation, you can't just, you know, put under the rug and think that it will go away. And there are certainly a number of underlying issues that I think are important for us as a nation to come to terms with, to understand, in order to actually move on. But I think that the film suggests that it's not only important to really examine what happened and get to the bottom of what happened at Abu Ghraib, but also looking ahead, that unfortunately a number of the policies that were put into place after 9/11 that I believe contributed to what happened at Abu Ghraib are still in place today. And I think it's important also to examine those policies and to try to, as a nation, come to terms with the fact that as of right now, we are continuing to have a policy that says it's okay to treat some people inhumanely.
And in fact, recent legislation immunizes retroactively the war crimes that were committed over the last few years.
Yeah, and not only that, you know, it says that we don't torture, but you can use evidence obtained by torture in these military trials. You know, the fact
right.
that we've gotten rid of habeas corpus for many of the detainees, as well as, you know, illegal aliens. All of these are precedent-setting actions that I think are very precarious and I find deeply concerning. To me, the film isn't just about what happened at Abu Ghraib, but it's about who we are as Americans and what we stand for in this world. And, you know, I think for 200 years, you can go all the way back to the American Revolution when British soldiers were torturing Americans, American prisoners of war, were beheading American prisoners of war. And there was a real sense in this country of, you know, an eye for an eye. Let's get back at these guys. Let's treat them the same way they're treating us. And when George Washington was asked how did he want to respond, what policy did he want to put into place, he said, treat them with dignity and respect. Treat them better than we treat ourselves. Because once we lose that, once we go down that path, we've lost what we're fighting for. And we become our enemy.
You know, it's striking to me that you keep talking about the Abu Ghraib incident as symptomatic of broader policies. And you talk not only about detainee abuse, prisoner abuse, but you talk about the loss of habeas corpus or the watering down of the War Crimes Act. One of the things that the ACLU is doing, as you know, is litigating for records relating to the abuse and torture of prisoners, not just in Iraq, but in Afghanistan and at Guantanamo. And one of the things we've been worried about is that despite all of the evidence that we and others have been able to unearth about the treatment of prisoners, there is still a widespread belief that what took place at Abu Ghraib was aberrational and isolated, and that it wasn't part of a larger system of policies. Do you have the same impression that we do, that there is that misunderstanding out there, or do you think that people are starting to recognize the connection between each of these things?
Well, I hope that the film will contribute to that sense that this was much more systematic and systemic than we were told. You know, it documents the response of the administration coming off of Abu Ghraib, you know, saying this was, Donald Rumsfeld says we need not let the actions of a few define the many and define our country. This was, the sense that this was just Animal House on the night shift, that this was rogue soldiers behaving badly. And I think that the film documents very systematically and methodically the abuses that took place and how they were indicative of a much bigger procedure that was put in place by the administration after 9/11 that impacted not just what happened at Abu Ghraib, where we have the photographs documenting it, but that was absolutely standard operating procedure in a number of prisons throughout Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Guantanamo. One of the people we spoke to, Tony Lagaranas, who we didn't include this in the film, but he was on a mobile interrogation unit that operated throughout Iraq, and when he saw the photographs come out of Abu Ghraib, his initial impression was this was absolutely procedures that were coming down from the interrogators and from people higher up the chain of command, because he was able to travel to a number of different facilities throughout the country, and that was absolutely par for the course, standard operating procedure to bring in military police, to have them be a part of the process of softening up prisoners to make them ready for interrogations that would happen, and you know, the next day or the day after. And so, you know, this was, as far as I can tell, and from all of the everything I've read and all of the evidence that I have, absolutely, I say, standard operating procedure.
I think you're right that the film makes that connection really well. The other set of connections I think that the public needs to start making are the connections between the detention policies and the prisoner abuse policies, and policies like rendition, the CIA's policy of rendition, or the loss of habeas that came about because of the Military Commissions Act. And all of those things are part of the same assault on democratic values that we've seen over the last 5 years, and I think it's only now that that the public is starting to see those connections. And I think your film is going to, I hope that your film will go some way towards making people see those connections that have until now been somewhat invisible.
Right. Well, my hope is that, you know, people will watch the film, and which does, in fact, really focus on Abu Ghraib, but then be hopefully motivated to learn more about exactly what happened. And we've, on the HBO website, and made links to the ACLU, Amnesty International, Human Rights First, Human Rights Watch, and other organizations that are very actively taking on these issues. So my hope is that it will spark, you know, a lot of action in this area and a lot more awareness about these connections. I think that Alberto Mora, who, you know, works within the administration, is a Republican, but, you know, he, I think, is so articulate in talking about this idea of kind of what it means to America when you start down a road where you have a policy that says it's okay to treat any group of people inhumanely. And that you might think, well, let's torture this guy to get a little information, or let's say it's okay to treat this person horrifically, or you know, to abuse them or treat them in such inhumane manners. But once you say that's okay as a policy, it erodes at our soul. It erodes at who we are as a nation. It compromises us in so many other ways that are so significant in our and unstrategic that it is really, I think, what he would say, a kind of dangerous path to be walking down.
The film ends with a quote from Stanley Milgram, who the guy who presided over those experiments at Stanford. This is what he says: human nature cannot be counted on to insulate men from brutality and inhumane treatment at the direction of malevolent authority. A substantial number of people do what they're told. Now, it's true, and your film shows it, that a substantial number of people do what they're told. But as you mentioned, there are people who didn't do what they were told. There was Sergeant Darby, Joe Darby, who handed over photographs to the Defense Department's Criminal Division. And there was Alberto Mora, who was the General Counsel of the Navy, who vocally opposed the use of torture. Do you think that there are heroes in your story? Is that the right way to think of it?
Yeah, well, I absolutely think there were individuals who were willing to stand up to the authorities. Unfortunately, it required a certain type of person who was willing to stand up to authority, and most of us don't have that ability, and most of us are going to do what we are told. And so it takes a very, very unique individual to be in a situation like we saw at Abu Ghraib, where, you know, the conditions were horrific at the prison, where people were not trained to do what they were being asked to do. Most of the MPs who were involved in the abuse had no experience whatsoever in being prison guards, and had no expectation to be doing that kind of work. They were then further asked to be involved in interrogations, which again they had no experience or training to do, which also means you don't know what is normal and what is not. And when you have procedures that are being authorized, that's documented throughout the film, that say it's okay to, and in fact encourage people to keep the prisoners awake, to make sure that they don't have clothing, to sexually humiliate them, that it's very, and that that becomes a standard operating procedure, it's very hard to stand up against that. And so I do have great respect for the people like Joseph Darby and Alberto Mora, who was willing to go against the grain. But I think it's important to note that what those procedures were, and what was standard at the time was, unfortunately, procedures that encouraged this type of behavior. I would also say that, to me, the other heroes in the film are the detainees who we interviewed, all of whom were released without charge after serving time at Abu Ghraib, so are presumably innocent, and from as much as far as I can tell, are absolutely innocent.
Was it difficult to persuade them to talk to you?
And I would just add, as were the majority of people who were at Abu Ghraib at the time. It was difficult. Well, we worked through a number of lawyers who out of Philadelphia who were representing the detainees in a class action suit against independent contractors. So after kind of building a trusting relationship with those lawyers who then felt comfortable talking to the detainees and identifying a handful who would be willing to talk with us, they really kind of worked on our behalf to encourage the detainees to be a part of the film. But what was the most challenging aspect of that was really the just logistically trying to film them. We originally were going to film them in Iraq, but they felt the situation there was too unsafe. We then made arrangements for them to fly to Jordan and got them visas and tickets, but they were turned away at the airport and told they were on a security list. They weren't able to get out of the country. We then arranged for them to fly to Turkey. They were able to get to Turkey and then detained at the airport in Turkey, told that they were going to have to go back. But we managed to persuade the personnel there to let them go, and ended up interviewing them at a hotel in Istanbul. And, you know, they were just extraordinary. I mean, the stories they told really made me feel that the photographs were just the tip of the iceberg in terms of the abuse that was committed at Abu Ghraib and the day-in, day-outness of it all. And I just, you know, after all that had been done to them, for them to be willing to speak with me, an American, was so humbling, and I think took enormous amount of courage. And I'm so grateful because I think they add so much depth and dimension to the film and to America's understanding of exactly what went on there.
Rory, what was it like to interview the military police who had participated in some of the abuses?
Well, it was definitely interesting to interview the military police, and I think that I, like so many other Americans and probably people around the world, had prejudgments about who these people were, who the MPs were, who were involved in the abuse. And there was something immediately disarming about meeting a number of the MPs who were involved, and as well as the MIs who were involved in the abuse. I think that there was something disarming just because they, you know, the first person I interviewed was Jeval Davis, and there was something disarming about meeting him because he was likable, quite frankly, and he had humanity and he had humor, and there was a sweetness about him. And there's such a disconnect between that person who I was sitting across from asking questions and then what I saw in the photographs and the images and what he had done while he was at Abu Ghraib. And that was true for a lot of the MPs and MIs who I interviewed. And again, it's this idea that I think so many of us have, that they must be monsters, they must be psychopaths, they must be crazy people. And they're not. They are not unlike you and me, thrown into a situation where there's enormous power and control, and it becomes very, very hard, even though it's so unimaginable for so many of us to think that we're capable of that level of abuse. It becomes very, very hard when you're in that situation to actually question it and to say no. And there are very few people, as we saw, who were actually willing to do that. And it took an extraordinary person to say no, as opposed to the ordinary person who is much more likely to do what they're told, as the experiment attests.
Were they eager to talk to you, or did you have to convince them?
It took some level of convincing for all of them. There was resistance. Most of them had just served time, and I think that in large part they wanted to put this experience of Abu Ghraib behind them. They had served their time. They wanted to move on with their lives. But I think they also all felt that the full story of what had happened there really hadn't gotten out, and that there was a sense that it was, you know, just Animal House on the night shift, and that was kind of the dominating view in the media and coming from the administration and the powers that be, and that was not in their experience or in their knowledge base what happened at all. And so I think they were invested in telling a more truthful version of what happened. But of course, they had done interviews, some of them, where they had been burned, and so it took a good amount of trust building to get them to agree to be filmed and
right.
Be a part of this project. And I think in terms of what the effect was on me, that this was a really hard project. It was probably the hardest film in many ways that I've made. And I think that in part had to do with the fact of just having to live with the photographs day in and day out, that they're disturbing and unsettling and unpleasant. And the idea of that we're all so much more capable of committing these acts and that than I had originally thought was something that I really didn't expect when I went into this project, and is a scary idea. And what it says to me is that we really do need our governments and our institutions to protect us from behaving badly. And so when our institutions and our governments are telling us to behave badly, then that scares me. And I feel like that's a very, very dangerous road to walk down. And I feel like we're going down it. And I'm deeply concerned. And I think that speaking with the prisoners who had been abused, and the you know, the sinking feeling I had when I was doing those interviews of, I've done a lot of projects on human rights abuse that have happened in other countries, and most of which are kind of what we would consider the worst of the worst, dictators and so on to think, I cannot believe that America is doing this to these guys.
Well, I think that's a thought that many Americans had when they saw the photographs in the first place, too.
Right. Well, hopefully, you know, that reaction and response, we can try to channel it into a more productive energy that can really topple this idea that, you know, torture is accepted foreign policy and that treating people inhumanely is okay.
Well, let's hope so. Rory, thanks again for taking the time to talk today.
To learn more about the ACLU's work on torture issues, Rory Kennedy's new film, Ghosts of Abu Ghraib, and additional podcasts from the ACLU, go to www.aclu.org/ghosts of Abu Ghraib.